Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from this week's top news stories.
The job really needs someone who can deal with legislative and regulatory issues, which is something I had recused myself from, given the dual role. So, in reality, any kind of a longer-term thing, requires one or the other.
Bill supports charter schools as he supports public schools generally. And again, I think as people learn to know his record and learn to know him, they'll see he's just a great advocate for public education.
That would actually make New Hampshire one of the pioneers on the handheld cell phone use ban. Whereas 43 states ban text messaging right now, only 12 states prohibit the handheld cell phone.
The problem with using interstate corridors is, as you know, there's federal, I think, not very well thought out federal obstacles to allowing us to do that. But if anyone can get it done, it's Governor Haslam, myself, and others. We would love to find solutions to get our southern neighbors the juice that they need without destroying our pristine forests.
The last person to make the top three tonight is Alex Preston.
You know I'm not one to break promises. I don't want to hurt you, but I need to breathe.
From the top, that was former Senate President Peter Bragdon on why he's resigning from the Senate at the end of the session. Governor Maggie Hassan explaining her nomination of Bill Duncan to the State Board of Education. Kara Masick of the Governor's Highway Safety Association speaking in favor of a measure to ban the use of handheld devices while driving. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin voicing his support for the Granite State to find alternate routes for the Northern Pass hydropower project. And Mount Vernon's own Alex Preston, who has advanced to American Idol's top three. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you as we examine these and other stories. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Our guests for this week's roundup include Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Hi, good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, thanks for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
And Gary Reynos here, State House reporter for the Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, thanks for your time.
You're welcome, Laura.
Well, and Gary, I want to turn to you first. The House and Senate have a new fiscal issue to tackle, even though it's a non-budget year. They thought they were off the hook. They figured out the budget last year. But they need to do something, Gary, about the Medicaid enhancement tax. Now, really briefly, can you just explain what this is and how much of a hole might the loss of this tax create?
Well, this is a long-time tax since 1991. It's basically tax hospital services. They used to just sort of match it and then send it back. But in 2011, it became a real tax, as they say, and the hospital has been fighting it ever since.
They used to trade money back and forth with the federal government.
They used it to match federal money. You kept that and then sent the money back to the hospitals. But in 2011, they said, well, we're going to keep most of this. So that's when we started having problems. When money was going back, nobody cared. Now they do care. So what we're looking at is about $185 million a year. But you have to sort of step back from that and say it's really about $72 million that goes into the general fund. That's the real issue, because the rest of that money is going back to the hospitals through either provider payments or uncompensated care. But it's still $185 million that they're going to have to find some other way to pay for.
Wow. So, Norma, what are some of the ideas for dealing with that, either through spending cuts, reducing programs, or finding new revenues?
Well, the governor's been meeting with the hospitals who can't agree among themselves. Some would like the tax to continue. They benefit. Some would like to get rid of it. You have the Senate with its own ideas. They would like to phase the tax out, starting not next year but the year after. And they would also take some money. I guess you could say, I won't call it a new scam, but we now are moving into a phase where we are putting people through the exchange on Medicaid expansion. That's going to start this summer. The Affordable Care Act has begun putting people through the exchange. All of those insurance policies are taxed at 2% and has been a state tax for a long time. But now we're going to have maybe 50,000 people or more going through buying up insurance policies. And that money would be used to pay for some of the loss. We would be taxing ourselves, because if we are using federal money to put people through the exchange to subsidize the purchase of those policies, we're essentially taxing ourselves. So it's a different way of paying for health care. The House, on the other hand, is trying to put on the table something that's, I don't know, you could say it's prettying up the pig in a way. They've just drawn a little lipstick on the
prettying up the pig.
Yes, they have a bill that would, or a proposal that would just change a few terms. It wouldn't change who's taxed, how much you were taxed. It would try to assert that the state has constitutionally is in the right in imposing this tax. And there was another proposal that would expand it to four other categories. There are 19 categories that the federal government allows us to tax, and this would just expand it a little. I think we're looking at a very long conference committee.
Well, and this possible loss of a tax, Dean Spiliotis, came up in another vote this week. Casino supporters said, hey, we're going to lose the Medicaid enhancement tax, so all the more reason to pass a casino. But that didn't hold the day, did it?
No, that's right. Just one quick point on what Norma was saying. You know, the interesting thing about the conference committee is that whatever the committee does is going to have to sort of anticipate what the Supreme Court eventually says. So, you know, they're going to try to come up with some kind of a compromise on this to fill the hole, but we haven't yet had a final ruling from the Supreme Court. So whatever they come up with can conceivably then be exposed to the same sort of lawsuits if the people who are taxed feel that it's unconstitutional. And, yeah, so one of the arguments we heard was one way to fill the hole was to get the millions of dollars that casino supporters say would come from the two casino bill that was defeated last week. So we had this motion to reconsider. It failed by 20 votes this time, although they did not vote to indefinitely postpone it, which means it could conceivably come up yet again. You know, my feeling on casinos all along has been that, you know, at base, it's really the two sides are really sort of entrenched in terms of their principles, pro and against. I know after this last vote, I think some supporters started to think, well, if we just get the right mix of incentives, we might get a casino bill through. But my belief is probably the most likely way to get casinos would be to be a change in the makeup of the individuals in the House.
You know, a
big change, get more pro-casino people in the House. I don't think this is the type of issue where simply tweaking the incentives is going to be enough to get it through. And I think that's what we saw this week.
Yeah, last time it passed by lost by just one vote. Go ahead, Norma.
And I think that the pro-casino people have tried and tried and tried and tried. So it's a shift that I think is going to take more than just one election.
Yeah, Gary, I'd love your thoughts, too, on why concerns over possible lost revenue from this hospital tax weren't enough to put casinos over the top.
Well, there are certain entrenched values here where people are just not going to vote for a casino gambling. They just don't believe it's right for New Hampshire. I mean, we were trying to entice people with revenue sharing. They've been trying to entice it with the lost revenue from the MET and various other things. But if you look at the vote, I mean, ironically, it was 172 who were voting, the same 172 that we had last week when it was one vote. This time it was 20 votes. But what was really interesting is that we only had 20 people not there, not voting on Wednesday, which was incredible because it's usually between 35 and 50 people that are absent every day.
Wow.
So they really turned out, people turned out on both sides.
Well, and that's a point you've often made, Norma. Part of these votes depends on the ideology, how people feel, the particulars of the bill. Part of these votes depend on who shows up.
It's who shows up and, you know, whether there was a joke going around the halls that they were getting people off their hospital beds, but I don't know if it was true. But I have heard of that over the many years that people have come in that way.
Let me invite our listeners to join us again. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here today on The Exchange. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Join us as we talk about some of the big stories in the news around the Granite State this week, from the casino bill that went down once again to new concerns about the loss of a hospital tax. A little bit later, we'll talk about the very real possibility of New Hampshire adopting a law banning the use of handheld devices while driving. Join us on those stories and more, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Another vote this week, Dean Spiliotis in the full Senate voting against a minimum wage increase, which the House had wanted. How much was this bill looking to raise the wage by?
It was intended to start in 2015 at $8.25 an hour. It would go up to $9 an hour in the following year and then be indexed to inflation thereafter. And the state minimum wage was taken out with the O'Brien legislature a few years ago. So we've basically relied on the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 an hour. The Obama administration has been pushing for a federal minimum wage of $10.10 per hour. That has not gone anywhere and is not likely to in the future. What's so fascinating to me is the way in which this minimum wage issue has become kind of a core litmus test for both parties. It's almost an economic version of the divide over abortion, pro-choice, right-to-life supporters, where your support or opposition to a minimum wage tracks exactly with which party you belong to, and if you deviate at all, you're likely to be punished. And so I think this is shaping up to be a huge issue in the next two election cycles. Republicans cite this congressional budget office study that says 500,000 jobs would be lost if the federal minimum wage is bumped up to $10. So, Republicans uniformly say it's a bad idea. It'll force employers to cut entry-level jobs. Democrats say it's a fairness equity issue. You just bump people up to a living wage. So this is going to be perhaps one of the biggest issues of the next election.
All right. Well, coming up, if you're behind the wheel right now, put down that smartphone. A bill to ban the use of handheld devices while driving is on its way to Governor Hassan's desk. How do you feel about this coming law? Hands-free device use will still be allowed. Is that fair? Let us know what you think. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, and keep it right here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You can make sure your membership gift to NHPR goes as far as it can with our corporate match program. Many businesses around the state match your employees' donations to NHPR. You can essentially double the impact of your membership gift. Find out if your company participates at nhpr.org. More of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the national hour of the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com. From Wellscroft Fence Systems, providing fencing solutions, garden protection, and deer exclusion for farms, homes, and businesses since 1978. Information at wellscroft.com. And Downs Racklin Martin, offering statewide trust and estate services with attorneys Tom Shatari, Jake Wheeler, and Wilhelmine Digmans Wheeler. Information at drm.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the big stories that made headlines this week, and we'd like to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there if you'd like. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Gary Reno, just before the break, we were talking about the state Senate this week voting against increasing New Hampshire's minimum wage, not up to the $10.10 that President Obama has been seeking, but up to about $8.25, I think is what Dean said. You wanted to jump in there. Go ahead.
Well, I thought it was one of the more contentious debates we've actually had in the Senate this year, where they were actually going after each other over things. It wasn't as, usually it's been pretty easygoing and very polite, but this one became a little contested and a little touchy at times. And it's because I think both parties look at this as a wedge issue in the upcoming election. And it's all political at this point. It's hardly, it's lost a lot of the low-down things that people wanted from it, and it's just become a real political issue.
All right. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Norma Love, both the House and Senate have now passed a bill banning the use of handheld devices behind the wheel. Now, that's my simple explanation of it, but just remind us of some of the particulars of this bill.
Well, this, we're talking about basically about smartphones, although the older type flip phones and candy bar style phones are still an issue. You can't hold the phone up to your face if you're an adult. If you're under 18, you can't talk on the phone at all, even with using a Bluetooth device. A lot of the newer cars have Bluetooth in them, and it integrates with your phone. So that would be perfectly legal. You can also set the phone down on the seat or on the console or have it stuck to your dash and hit it to turn it on and talk on the speaker. What they're trying to get away from is people holding the phone up to their ear or texting, which has been illegal for a while, or surfing the web, or programming a GPS device or any of those things while driving or stopped at a stoplight or stop sign. I think that's going to catch people off guard because the thought there is that people, you know, not only they irritate people behind them, but the light changes and somebody plows into the back of you and maybe pushes you into the intersection. So this will take effect if Hassan signs it, which she is expected to do July 1st, 2015.
2015, not right. 14.
Nope.
So we've got a year to
That's
adjust to this.
Have an education campaign to try and reach out to people and say if police see you holding the phone up to your ear, you could get a ticket and be charged a violation and a $100 fine the first time.
Okay, this is a big cultural change. Let's just say, you know, if you're sitting, I don't know, at the corner somewhere, waiting for the light to change, you can cross the street and you just watch the cars go by. I don't know, Dean, yeah. One out of every three, one out of every four people is on the phone. This is a big cultural shift for New Hampshire.
Yeah, the big game changer here is the rise in the prevalence of texting, particularly among younger people, but people in general. I think texting has really started to supplant emailing. It's a really easy interface and convenient interface on smartphones. It is true. It is going to be a bit of a culture shock. I agree with you. I look around at stoplights and, you know, probably at least half or more of the people are looking down in their laps at their phone. You know, talking on a cell phone is not ideal, but at least you can sort of have your eyes on the road. The problem is people texting on their steering wheels while they're driving because you do. There's a lot of research that shows that your sense of how long you've been looking away from the road is not in keeping with the reality of it, and that's real dangerous. So it's going to be. I guess there's probably going to be a fair bit of sneaking going on. So we'll see how well this is actually enforced, but it's going to be a big shock to people, I think.
Well, it's interesting, Dean, you talked about texting. That's already illegal, though.
Well, so. It's illegal to send a text. It's not illegal to read a text, so you can actually read your text. And I see people texting anyway. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, speed limits are set and people break speed limits all the time, so it's the same sort of issue. But I think we have seen a rise in the number of these sort of high-profile fatalities from people texting and drifting across the center line, et cetera.
Well, the Department of Safety actually said it's the second leading cause of fatal accidents in the state, second only to drunk driving or DWI. So it's a serious problem right now.
Where does this put New Hampshire, Gary, or Norma, in terms of state laws on devices while driving? I mean, once this is on the books next year, are we one of the strictest states?
We will be one of the strictest. I think there are like 14 other states that banned handheld cell phones. There are a lot of states that ban texting and driving, but we certainly will be on the forefront.
All right, let's take a call again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Join us on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the exchange. Barbara's calling from Hollis. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. So my question is, well, first of all, I understand the logic behind this law, but my concern is that it has to be a built-in system in the car because that means that I don't have the opportunity to use my phone if I do not have that kind of a system. And I cannot afford to go up with a new car.
And Barbara, are you on a cell phone right now?
I am.
Are you driving?
I'm hands-free. Yes, I am, and I'm hands-free.
You're hands-free. Oh, because it sounds like you're all set then, Norma, right? She's all set.
Well, she's all set if she's talking hands-free. There are also everybody who has Bluetooth capability in their phone could get one of these little over-the-ear devices. Or during the debate in the Senate, they talked about other adapters that older cars could put in to to use, but, I mean, even just putting your phone on the speaker. Now, the really old phones, which apparently some of the state senators have, probably wouldn't work, and those are the ones without Bluetooth, without any of these capabilities.
Wow. Well, Barbara, thank you. Did you want to jump back in there, Gary?
That's okay.
No? Okay. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Call us on your cell phone or your regular phone, 1-800-892-6477. I did want to ask you, I think, Gary, and perhaps you too, Dean, about the Northern Pass. The federal government got involved recently. About a week ago, Gary, the Department of Energy released lots of alternate routes for the Northern Pass. Now, what's the federal Department of Energy's role in this project?
Well, they ultimately have to approve it. I mean, obviously, the site selection committee is the one here in New Hampshire, but the federal authorities also have to approve this. And what's been interesting is the congressional delegation has been pushing for alternative routes, including burying the lines.
Which the company has said is too expensive.
It's too expensive, but when the federal Department of Energy released their alternative routes, that was one of the suggestions that they could bury the lines.
Dean, what are your thoughts on this? You know, this has been going on for a long time, and now finally here's the federal government stepping in. How does that sort of change the mix here?
It's interesting. I think it has heartened opponents a little bit because the government came out with this sort of long list of possibilities, not all of which I think will be seen as serious possibilities. I think they will eventually narrow it down to a smaller subset of workable options. But, you know, one of the options listed there was burying the entire project, and the supporters have said that's unrealistic. If I have my numbers right, I think it costs $3 million per mile, but if they bury it, it's something like $12 million per mile or thereabouts. It's a big gap in terms of the cost. So, I think it is fuel for opponents to say, well, you know, the government has all these other possibilities. We need to look at them. And again, the supporters are going to have to make the cost argument. But I think it just sort of kind of complicates people knew it was coming. I think it's part of the process. But certainly for supporters, it complicates the road forward because now all these other possibilities are at least theoretically in play. And that could – I think it's just going to delay the whole thing even further.
Well, and the fact that they released a lot of alternate routes,
not just
here's one or two. But
right. But they did note that, you know, these are all the possibilities, but we're really likely going to focus on a smaller subset. But nonetheless, it kind of widens the playing field. And it takes away the argument from the supporters, at least partially, that there are no other options except maybe, you know, this little 8 extra miles that they were going to bury.
Norma.
Well, I think you have to step back and think about this from a global perspective. One, I think we do need the energy, or we need energy from somewhere. Two, no one in the first instance is going to want to pay more money. So you negotiate. We're in a high-stakes game here of how much do I have to do? So whatever Northern Pass is told it has to do, I don't think it's going to be bury all of it. But I can't believe that it won't be more than 8 miles. So somewhere in the middle, if they want this project, is going to be, here, this is what we'll approve, this is what we're willing to do, and they'll say, we can't afford it, or they'll say, yeah, but that makes the energy price too high. And I think that's what's going on globally.
Yeah, well, join us with your comments and questions, whether it's about the Northern Pass, what the Department of Energy had to say this past week, or some of the subjects we talked about earlier, the possible downfall of a hospital tax, blowing a hole in the state budget, and how the state might respond to that. You can join us on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Gary Reyna, we talked just a minute ago about the handheld device use while driving and the ban on that. While we're talking about driving, Gary, the House and Senate this week disagreed on whether billboards by our highways should be allowed to advertise liquor. Now, what was this about?
Well, the state law that's there on the books now basically gives the Liquor Commission the authority to basically approve any kind of advertising. And one of the things that has always done is said that we're not advertising liquor on billboards. And the bill got through the Senate by one vote after about 5 or 6 votes that were tied to allow liquor advertising on billboards. In the House, it was a little close in the Commerce Committee, but it really wasn't that close on the House floor. They said, no, we don't want this. We don't want to change anything. This is not the way we want in New Hampshire. We don't want people coming in here and seeing big billboards advertising liquor and all the things that brings along. And so consequently, we have no change in the law.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Norma, the beer distributors were against this.
Well, I think one of the issues here is beer is really not sold at the liquor stores anyway. It's sold in grocery stores.
Right.
And if you're going to be advertising liquor on the highways, you're more likely to be advertising what's sold in the liquor stores. I think one issue that some people brought up that seemed kind of interesting, one, they advertise on the highways there's a state liquor store ahead. And two, we advertise our liquor in Massachusetts. So it's not like we aren't advertising. It's a matter of who is getting that benefit.
Yeah. And if you're a beer person, then you're not getting that benefit.
And part of the thing, too, is that because of the local regulations largely and because of the cost, I mean, there aren't any more billboards going up these days. So there's basically a finite number, not because they're capped, but because of the reality, of the financial reality. So there was concern that these big liquor companies would come in and buy up all these billboards and local people would be sort of kept out of the game.
All right. Well, again, the number here on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that came in. Someone didn't give his or her name, but this person says, I find it odd that everyone on the air seems to take it for granted that casinos will happen at some point, that we need to change who we elect to match your own preferences. How about focusing on creating jobs, fixing our broken infrastructure, which will help the tourism industry and all of us in New Hampshire? I don't think anybody here was assuming that, you know, we need casinos. I think you guys were just trying to reflect the debate in the legislature. But to the broader point, Dean, you know, casino opponents like this person say this isn't what New Hampshire should be all about.
Right. You know, that's one of the fundamental arguments has been about the quality of life, New Hampshire's kind of role as a tourist destination with the natural beauty and the wilderness, et cetera, the environment, and that this would be kind of a social ill for the state. No one was here was suggesting one way or the other whether we should have casinos. I was simply saying that this is the kind of issue, in some respects, for many people, it's a social issue. Social issues are not tweakable with incentives usually as opposed to an economic issue. So this is an unusual issue in the sense that you have kind of economic arguments, which are tweakable, coexisting with social issues, which tend to be more rooted in first principles. Typically in that situation, when the first principles are winning out, the way that supporters change the game is by changing the people on the playing field. So it's simply kind of a hypothetical argument about what they might do if they want casinos, help get people elected who support casinos. But
yeah,
it's not expressing a personal preference one way or the other.
So they can tweak the bill however much they want.
You can tweak economic incentives. Yeah. I think a big portion of the casino bill is a social issue about morality, about social ills, et cetera, and that is a lot more resistant to economic incentives.
Well, thank you for that email. Again, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Norma Love, 2014 seems to be a big year for political retirements in New Hampshire. A couple weeks back, Terry Norelli said she would no longer be Speaker of the House. She would no longer even be in the House. A couple more announcements this week. Who's moving on, Norma?
Well, Executive Counselor Deborah Pignatelli has some short-term health issues and that would make it difficult for her to campaign. So after about 25 years as a House member, as a state senator, as an executive counselor, she's going to step back and take care of that. Peter Bragdon, who is a former Senate president, announced that he's going to leave June 6th. The session ends June 5th. He was hired by the Health Trust last year, which is part of the local government center's operations, to be their executive director. And there was a lot of contentiousness about his being in that position and whether it was a conflict of interest. He stepped back from being Senate president as a result. He also has recused himself on a number of votes. But there are some who felt it was ethically improper and challenged him in the Legislative Ethics Committee.
It just got too tricky balancing those two jobs, given that his job is very involved in state policy.
Yeah, he was cleared of and formally resolved a couple of issues there. But I think that, as he said, putting his full-time effort into being executive director in the long term, this was made more sense.
Well, and speaking of politics, Dean, there was some politicking this week over Governor Hassan's choice for state school board, Bill Duncan. But yesterday he was approved by the executive council on a partisan 3-2 vote. What was the issue right. with Mr. Duncan?
Yeah, this has actually gotten a fair bit of attention. Governor Hassan, as you mentioned, nominated Bill Duncan to run the State Board of Education. Mr. Duncan is the lead plaintiff in that lawsuit, which challenges the business education tax credits to fund scholarships. If you remember, we've talked several times about this particular issue moving through the courts in which businesses can contribute to a scholarship fund as a tax credit. And some of the, what was challenged was whether or not that money could be used for private and religious education. Opponents have argued that it hurts or deprives the public school system of money that it rightly deserves. So, you know, she's essentially pointing to head the department, the person who's kind of the lead plaintiff in this particular lawsuit, although, you know, Governor Hassan has I think, filed a brief as a friend of the court. So she sides with Bill Duncan on this. So Republicans were not happy. But in New Hampshire, nominations go through the executive council. They're not confirmed by the Senate. So, you know, it's interesting with Deb Pignatelli retiring, if that seat were to go Republican in November, we'd have a 3-2 Republican majority. He probably would have not gotten through. But because we currently have 3-2 Democrats, he was approved.
All right. Well, that'll be interesting to see what Mr. Duncan does on the State Board of Education. And as we've seen, the State Board, even though it's local control here in New Hampshire in terms of education policy, they do set standards and so forth. So it'll be interesting. Here's an email that came in from Jordan in Auburn who says, as an environmentalist, I've been ambivalent on Northern Pass. However, a recent suggestion swayed me. If the federal government, which controls the interstate, allows for the lines to go generally along I-93, that would cut down on habitat fragmentation. Deforestation would allow for greener power to come into the country. Eco-controversy of hydro aside, that dam is already operating, so it's moot. Once the lines reach the populated south, they could then be routed, since it's mostly deforested anyway. Still takes some doing, Jordan says, but that would get me more solidly behind it. So, Gary Reno, there we have someone from an environmental standpoint saying, you know, maybe I could be okay with this thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think what most environmentalists have been pushing for is to bury the lines anyway, and going down the interstates 91 to 93, which was talked about by the governor from Vermont. I mean, this has always been an option that a lot of environmentalists have been pushing for.
Okay, Jordan, thanks for the email. Coming up, the New Hampshire Supreme Court rules that a man who wants to have a license plate that says cops lie may do so, despite a state law stating that vanity plates, a reasonable person would find offensive, are not allowed. What do you think of this court decision? Should we be able to say what we want on our license plates, or are there limits? Let's hear from you. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. A White House report on climate change urges immediate action, and Monica Lewinsky speaks out. Then, in South Sudan, the government agrees to suspend attacks on rebels. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the Dairy Field School, inspiring students in grades 6 through 12 to excel in school, college, and beyond. Enrolling now for summer programs at dairyfield.org/summer. And from Herbert Toyota, proud to be a family-owned Toyota dealer for over 20 years, offering a wide selection of all-purpose and green-friendly vehicles in Epping and online at herberttoyota.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments about some of the headlines that caught your attention this week. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Twitter at @NHPRExchange. And Norma Love, Dean Spiliotis, and Gary Reno, a couple more stories I did want to follow up on with all of you. And this is one that caught a lot of people's attention, Dean. A Guilford dad made headlines when he spoke out in frustration that he wasn't warned about a book being used in his daughter's ninth grade English class. Now, what's the book in question, first of all, Dean?
This is Jodi Picoult's 19 Minutes, which is a fictionalized account of a shooting in a New Hampshire school. It has won some book awards. It has some scenes of violence, and apparently – I have not read the book, but apparently has one graphic sex scene in it. This is a book that had been available for teachers to assign since 2007. I think it's only been assigned a couple times. But in any event, this particular parent's daughter was assigned the book. He was unhappy about it. The school board had a hearing. Apparently, they were to be limited to 2 minutes per person. He was not happy with the two-minute limit, kept talking over other people. They eventually had him removed. The irony of it is it actually brought more attention to the whole issue. You know, the Guilford School District had said they're going to continue to allow the book to be assigned. But instead of having a situation where parents have to have their students opt out, it's now going to be the case that parents have to agree in advance to having their child read a controversial book, that they're going to be more transparent about the process of assigning the books. But William Baer, this particular individual, was arrested and I think charged with disorderly conduct. And these kinds of issues pop up from time to time. Her books in general have been fairly controversial, but they are often assigned as well. And she has spoken out in support of having students read the book in school, in
high
school.
I think I read that the policy in the past has been that they've told parents, hey, this book is coming. Hey,
right.
It's got some violence and some sex.
Right. But then you had to have your child opt out of reading it. Now you're actually going to have to give affirmative acceptance of allowing your child. I guess it's a slight adjustment, but I think the thinking is it will sort of make the parents have a more firm say in whether or not they do it.
Yeah. Have you, Norma and Gary, you've been covering the state for so long. Have you seen these issues pop up before, Norma, where parents are, you know, not feeling good about a book that's been assigned and protesting?
It comes up occasionally. My question is always, it's kind of, we talked about this on a play not long ago on the show,
That's right. Sweeney Todd. Yeah, about a month or so ago.
At what point do you challenge your child to go beyond the blasé, I guess, or the safe? And I understand a parent's concern, and I think, yes, parents should know, and they should have some say in it. Could that 9-year-old or 10-year-old have gone to the public library and read the book?
This was a ninth grader.
Yeah. Could they have gone to the library and read the same book? I mean, these things are out there and they're available. The question is whether it should be sanctioned by a government, by a school. And I think that is probably the question.
All right. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that just came in with Rob about a story I wanted to ask you folks about. This has to do with the man who wanted to put Cops Lie on his vanity license plate. The state said, no, you can't do that. And he went to court about it. And as I said earlier, the state Supreme Court this week said, yes, you can put that on there. Here's what Rob says. He says, I see no problem with the Cops Lie plate. We need to get our sense of humor back in this country. As long as the plates are not racist, sexist, or homophobic, why not have a little fun? Banning everything because a few people may claim to be offended is getting out of hand. I'm tongue-in-cheek offended by the Obama campaign bumper stickers I still see on people's cars, but I don't think they should be made to remove them. Rob, thanks for the email. And Gary, just give us the broader context of this whole Cops Lie case.
Well, this David Montenegro, I believe it is, wanted to put this on his license plate, Cops Lie. And the law says that a reasonable person would find offensive to good taste. But obviously it leaves it up to the Department of Motor Vehicle, whoever it is, to decide. And the court said, that's way too vague. It's not enough to – it's constitutionally too vague. You can't just throw it out there like that. It's just way too wide, and you're leaving discretion up to somebody that really shouldn't be having it. And so consequently, they said it's a free speech issue. And therefore, if you want to say that, you can do that.
So, Dean, what does that mean? We can put anything on our license plates?
Well, that's the question. It was interesting. When I read the initial story that he had been denied this particular license plate, I thought there's no way that that's going to stand. And he also did something interesting. A few months after he was denied, he requested the plate Great Government, using an abbreviation of Great Government. That was approved immediately. So the problem is, as your email mentioned, your emailer said, as long as it's not racist, sexist, or homophobic, people can even differ on what is sexist. I mean, that's, for an example, people will differ. This is just an inherently difficult thing to define. I mean, maybe they'll have more guidelines, but these types of things are always open to challenge on First Amendment grounds, even if there are stricter guidelines in the future.
Norma,
I believe he changed his name to Human.
Yes.
And is actually probably thrilled that he's getting the publicity around this, so it raises the level of awareness. I can remember going back over the years when the state prison inmates were making plates. They used to have to try and catch plates that they would try and slip through that had obscene references.
So the inmates, you mean?
Yes.
They would stamp out plates that had swear words on them?
Or you would
clever on time,
clever,
and stuff
clever.
Like
so I think that I agree with Dean. This is always going to be an issue. What's in the eye of the beholder? But certainly, they sent it back to the lower court to revisit and see. Maybe there are some standard guidelines that could be developed that would be a little bit easier to follow than, well, what does Norma think today, or Gary think, or Dean?
Then we're going to be having to depend on the legislature to decide good taste, and that may be a problem too.
Yeah, well, given 424 lawmakers, that would be a big jury to decide what was in good taste and what was not. Well, thanks for the email, Rob. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Olivier, I did want to ask you about a very personal New Hampshire story that made national news. And Norma Love, I'm going to go to you first. Former Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson announced a divorce from his husband. This was on the front page of the Concord Monitor, several other New Hampshire papers. It was in the New York Times, of all things. Why was one individual's divorce big news?
Well, I think that the fact that he was the first openly gay Episcopal bishop named as bishop, it propelled him into the spotlight in a way that is very, very difficult for any personal relationships, and Mark Andrews certainly stood by him for many, many years. Bishop Robinson retired recently. He's been on the national stage, and I think he's trying to make the point now that just because you love someone doesn't mean, just like in a heterosexual relationship, it can always work out as a marriage, and that's the point that he made. And I think that he made it on the national stage because he was thrust there when he was elected bishop.
Do you want to jump in on that, Dean? Were you surprised that this made front page news?
No, I was not. I think for the reasons that Norma mentioned as well. And, you know, supporters of gay marriage that have argued that this is just a sign that of normalcy for the institution of marriage. We have a very high divorce rate in the country. He was with his partner for almost 30 years. They were only married for 4 of those 30 years, yet now they've reached the end of their relationship. So supporters have said that, you know, gay marriages are really no different than heterosexual marriages, and there's likely to be a high rate of divorce there as well. But I think his status as this first openly gay bishop certainly made it kind of more public and somewhat national news.
Well, and here at New Hampshire Public Radio, our news team spent a lot of time this week looking into one particular topic, higher education. We spent a whole week on a series we called A Matter of Degrees, looking as a team at this in all its many facets. Joining us now for just a little bit more on that is NHPR News Director Sarah Ashworth. And Sarah, thank you for being here.
Hi, Laura.
So what were some of the major themes that you on the news team explored this week?
Well, I think one of the themes that came out right away was something that kicked off on Monday with the news that SNHU is going to offer this $10,000 bachelor's degree. So for us, that was good timing, and it also signaled a lot of the themes we had stumbled upon, this push for online education and changing the way that schools deliver education and degrees to students and making it more affordable. And this program that, you know, does not rely on classes or instructors or grades and really has an online model is something that we're seeing even at traditional schools. And one of our reporters, Michael Brinley, he took a look at, we started with this idea of wanting to see how UNH Law School was doing. And we know that they saw half the applications this year that they did 2 years ago, that their admissions are at the lowest point that they are in a decade. But then what we learned is that they're exploring online education as well. And that was a surprise to us, that this very traditional law school model you don't hear a lot of law schools offering online degrees, and UNH Law School is moving in this direction. And in the story, Michael had Dean John Broderick saying, you know, he always has an iPad in his hand, so why not explore this option for students? So that was one of the big themes. The other one, I think, was really this increased intensity on STEM education, an acronym that we now all know because it's so common in higher education and grade school and high school education as well. And the state has this goal to double graduates by 2025. And so every school is talking about how to increase STEM. We have a video up online that Emily Corwin and our digital producer Sarah Plour did that really looks at why it became this buzzword. And then also Emily explored how some schools are trying to keep students in STEM classes because you can get them there with the promise of this could lead to jobs, this is a good area to invest in, but then these classes tend to be pretty hard as well. So schools like Keene State are trying to find ways to make the classes more engaging for students. So that was something we stumbled upon.
Science, technology, engineering, right. and math, and that right. has become the big buzzword. You mentioned this, Sarah, but I want to ask you a little bit more. So some of the big themes, you know, the changing face of education, the emphasis on STEM, the use of technology, the cost, and huge concerns over that. And we certainly talked about that on the exchange. Give us some of the smaller stories or the little surprises that came up over the week.
Oh, sure. Yeah, those did come up through the week. One was I thought our reporter Sam Evans-Brown was looking at research being done at schools with this idea, is it harder to get grants for research? And, you know, these were things I didn't know were going on at campuses here in the state. I didn't know much about UNH's wave pools and the way that they test sonar, like the way they can search for missing airplanes. That's happening at UNH. We know that they have the big Cray supercomputer that runs, you know, costs more than $1 million to do this high-end physics research that many of us don't understand, but it's going on here at Durham. Those stories were surprising to me. We also learned about college summer revenue programs. There's a violin craftsmanship institute at UNH that happens in the summer where students can go for $1,000, adults, whoever wants to go, and it's brought in more than $100,000 for UNH.
That violin was craftsmanship.
Exactly. That was a program wow. I didn't know much about. And then our program Word of Mouth took a look at some interesting college courses that are happening all around the country. You know, you have professors talking about zombies and superheroes and beauty pageants. And so I thought that those were some neat segments as well. And apparently the beauty pageant classes actually has a very tough reputation at Oberlin College.
Yeah, so not all angst about the cost of college mm-hmm. and what we should be studying and not. What kind of feedback have you received from people, Sarah, on
well,
this?
Well, I think what we took away from this, and in talking with our digital director, Rebecca Lavoie, that people really do want to talk about this topic of higher ed. It's on the minds of a lot of people, whether you have kids in college right now or will have kids in college or have gone through the system here yourself, that this is, you know, this idea of what is the value of a degree? Do you need one? How can you do it in the most affordable way? And is it going to translate into a job? And is that now the focus of colleges? We hear more and more about job training programs and preparing the workforce in ways that haven't always been discussed about colleges, you know, and is that at the expense of the liberal arts programs? I feel like that was a lot of the feedback that we got. And our question, we had a question of the day every day. Yesterday, we had a question asking specifically that about STEM and the expense of liberal arts. We received a lot of comments on that. Today, we have a question of the day up, so you can still add to it. It's with all you've heard about rising tuition, high student debt, and the push for colleges to innovate, would you choose to go to school in New Hampshire? And you can send in a comment at comments@nhpr.org. You can go on Facebook. You can post it online as well. And this really gets to the heart of what was driving a lot of feedback as well, wanting to talk about the cost and the high in-state tuition here and the high student debt load that people have.
Well, I'll be really interested, actually, to hear how people respond to that. Given the tuition, given the debt, would you choose to go to school, higher education in New Hampshire? It'll be interesting to hear.
Right. We'll watch for those today.
Yeah, right. All right. Well, Sarah, stay with us for just a moment, if you could. I want to just let everybody know that next week on The Exchange, we're going to kick off our week with a great book about the time leading up to American involvement in World War II. Although we look at World War II as a time time of, you know, people coming together and so forth. Before Pearl Harbor, there was a very bitter debate in this country about whether we should get involved. So we're going to look at that on Monday. And of course, we've got all sorts of other stuff planned for next week as well. How about you, Norma Love? What stories will you be watching next week?
Well, Wednesday and Thursday are the final House sessions and Senate sessions to vote on bills. It's their deadline. Everything has to go, so to speak. And the biggest issue before us, we talked about at the top of the show, which was the hospital tax, what the House and the Senate do. But they'll be going to conference on that in the week after or a week after that.
And you told me before we went on the air, they wrap up or are trying to wrap up by June 5th, 6th,
June
Norma.
5th.
So earlier than that, June 30th.
June 5th,
last
just
year.
In time for filing period to open.
For the elections. Gary, how about you?
Same. We'll be the House and Senate are wrapping up their bills. We're going to get to revisit the death penalty again this week because the
really?
House, when the House committee attached it to a Senate bill, wanted to send it back. The Senate wants nothing to do with it. It's not going anywhere, but we're probably going to be revisiting the issue in the House again.
Okay. Dean, how about you?
Two things. Florida Senator Marco Rubio is going to be in state this weekend. He's giving a couple of talks at county Republican dinners. He's also, I think, here in part for Scott Brown, but he's someone who was mentioned frequently as a presidential candidate, has dropped recently in the polling. We're going to see if he can kind of get on track with that. And secondly, Alex Preston of Mount Vernon, as we heard in the opening, is in the final three at American Idol. That means he gets the famous hometown visit.
That's right. That's this weekend.
Yes. Even though he's from Mount Vernon, there's going to be a 4:30 parade on Saturday in Durham and then a 7 p.m. concert at the Whittemore Center at UNH, free and open to the public.
Well, and Dean, you're our drama dad. So
I am a drama dad. Yep. I'll keep you updated on how he does.
Sarah Ashworth is also with us, NHPR's news director. Sarah, how about you? What is your
team
going to be doing?
Well, as Norma and Gary said, our Josh Rogers will also be at the State House a lot next week. We're also looking up from the North Country, looking at redevelopment plans at the Balsams and some of the hiccups in those plans right now, too.
Right. A beautiful place, and that's been sitting there for a while. So,
right.
Okay. Real interesting stuff. Thank you all very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer of The Exchange is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with a new book on a critical time in U.S. history, the bitter debate leading up to American involvement in World War II. Then retracing the so-called Arab Spring and how optimism turned to disappointment. And later, religious freedom in a variety of debates this year, from the Affordable Care Act to public prayer to supplying services for same-sex couples. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Domestic Hour of the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners, and from the Melanson Company of Keenan Bow, with comprehensive roofing solutions for 80 years, adding solar to turn roofs into energy-producing assets, melanson.com. And Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank, customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations, online at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. The White House releases a report on climate change. The message from the president, this is not some distant problem of the future. The nominee to head the Department of Health and Human Services faces her first day of confirmation hearings. The House votes along partisan lines to form a panel to investigate